Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is MacBreak Weekly, Episode 7 for September 22nd, 2006. The safe word is banana. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Visa. Safer, better money. Life takes Visa. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, our weekly look at the news and views in the Mac world. Joining me right now, Scott Bourne from iLife Zone, Merlin Mann from 43folders.com. I'm Leo Laporte, and we're ringing up Anand right now from Anand Tech. It's good to see you guys once again.
Glad to be here.
Alex is
How's it going, Leo?
Good. Alex is taking the day off. I think he's in Detroit. He's in the Motor City. So he gets around. So we'll get him back next week. The reason we're calling Anand right now is we want to talk to him about a recent article in Anand Tech. Later this year, Intel's going to release a new processor, Clovertown. It's a Xeon core, but it's quad core. That is four processors in one die. And this is the thing that's most interesting. It will be pin compatible with the current Core 2 chips. So Anand runs one of the greatest enthusiast sites out there. We've loved for a long time, had you on the screensavers before. And you must have had a couple of Clovertowns just lying around, eh?
Yeah, you know, we kind of, every now and then we get that kind of stuff laying around.
It's not out yet.
No, not yet. It'll be out, Q4 is officially all Intel's saying.
So you have it way ahead of time.
Yeah, we actually had, we were playing with quad core back in June.
Wow.
So it's been ready for a very long time. It's just that now that we're getting closer to launch, we're able to talk about it a little more.
It's a little bit unusual for Intel to do such a big chip upgrade and make it pin compatible. It usually seems like they want you to buy a new motherboard if you're going to do something like this.
Yeah, that's definitely true on the desktop side. On the server side, the enterprise guys don't always go for that.
Interesting.
So you'll see it's obviously a big selling point for a lot of AMD's platforms in the past, and the timing wouldn't work out, and that on top of the fact that a lot of the enterprise guys aren't okay with revamping their designs.
Right. It's what the market will bear. What the market will bear, I guess. So the Clovertown in each die has four CPUs. It's like a core two quad.
So the way it's actually organized is it's two. If you look at it as if you take a single Woodcrest, if you put two Woodcrest die on the same package, that's what a Clovertown is.
Wow. And that means each of the two has its own dedicated cache and so forth?
Yes. Yeah, it's literally like you took two Woodcrests and put them on the same package.
So the Mac Pro that they're shipping right now has two Woodcrests, which is essentially a quad. You thought, let's see what happens if we drop a Clovertown into a Mac Pro.
Well, yeah, because that's, in the past, one of the problems with kind of upgrading any of the Macs is that not enough people really sell the processor upgrades, and the few people that do, those things are super expensive.
Well, they often require a daughter board. I mean, it's rare that you can just plug it right in.
Yeah, so, we have this Intel-based Mac, and that's one of the major benefits of a PC in that you can go to, like, a Newegg or someplace like that and get a mass-produced processor that's fairly cheap whenever you want to upgrade. And so, A, I wanted to test to see if we could just drop in any Woodcrest in there, and it worked just fine. And then the more interesting thing is, well, when quad-core comes out, if you buy a Mac Pro today, are you going to be sorry that you didn't wait the extra, whatever, 3 or 4 months? And the answer is no. You can. It looks like you can just drop one in.
I have to tell you, after reading your article, I immediately bought a Mac Pro because that was well, seriously, that was a selling point. It's like, well, great. If I ever need more headroom, I can get it. So you dropped them in, and OS. You didn't have to modify OS 10 or anything. It just saw all eight processors.
Yep, OS 10 is obviously was designed from the ground up to be a multiprocessor aware OS. It detected them, if you saw the screenshots in the article, it detected them as Core 2 Duo processors, but all 8 cores worked. I ran benchmarks. I can't talk about performance, but it was definitely faster.
As one would expect. In fact, you said you had a hard time maxing the things out.
Yeah, I mean, if you run something that is heavily multi-threaded and very CPU intensive, so things like 3D Studio Max under Windows or Cinebench, any of those kinds of things, you've got no problem stressing all 8 cores, and you'll see a noticeable performance increase. But any of our kind of
real world. Lesser,
yeah, and the thing is, if your real world applications happen to be very well multi-threaded and very processor intensive, then it's not a problem. But the fact of the matter is that our Mac benchmarking suite is just very, it's very early on in its progression.
Well, and a lot of the people who use Pro apps on the Mac will have, in fact, very highly threaded, very processor intensive apps. So I think that makes sense. I mean, it seems like something that would be very valuable. One thing you point out is that the clock speed right now on Clovertown is a little lower than the fastest clock speeds on the Woodcrest.
Yeah, and it's been reported online. For example, if you look at the desktop cores, it's looking like 2.66 gigahertz will be the fastest quad-core Kent Field, whereas the fastest Core 2 Duo runs at 2.93 right now.
Right.
So you're looking at basically one clock speed down from the max, maybe two, it depends. So there is going to be a trade-off. If you don't have a lot of very, very CPU-intensive applications that you're running constantly, you may actually be better off getting a pair of faster Woodcrests rather than a pair of slower Clovertowns.
That's one we'll just have to wait and see when you get your benchmarks out and people try this. And now that you've done it, I'm sure others will, although there are not as many people who have access to these chips. You guys seem to have some very good access to Intel stuff.
Yeah, you'll probably start seeing them. I know before Core 2 Duo launched, you could actually buy some on eBay. So I wouldn't be too surprised to see some of these things start appearing on eBay as well.
I figure by this time next year, I'll have upgraded the Mac Pro to Clovertown, and I'll have 8 processors, and I can really boast.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Apple's strategy is going to be, because it's like I said, it's not something that you can easily quantify in terms of performance.
Right. I think it just reassures people that there's somewhere to go.
Yes, absolutely.
It's very exciting.
You definitely do. One thing we noticed, though, was that you definitely start to run into I/O bottlenecks once you have 8 cores.
Sure.
Any kind of multitasking you're doing with it. Obviously, our testbed only had a single SATA drive, so that's one area where RAID would definitely benefit.
And a good RAID, not a BIOS RAID, but some real hardware RAID. Well, I thank you for your time, Anand. It's great to talk to you again. And Anand Tech is, of course, the place to go, your source for hardware analysis and news. And I'm glad to see you doing more Mac news. That's great.
Thank you, sir. It's good talking to you again, Leah.
Great to talk to you. Take care, Anand.
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye. What do you think, guys? I wasn't joking. That was the thing that put me over the top in buying a Mac Pro. Maybe that's kind of nutty on my part, but it was just nice. It kind of reassuring.
It wasn't my recommendation, Leo, that you relied on to buy the Mac Pro?
Well, that too. No, I think you told me that I didn't need more than an iMac, right?
No, I'm the one that said you needed the Mac Pro. Right, Alex is the one that said you didn't need more than an iMac.
I just need bragging rights, and now I got it. And if anybody,
well, I'm glad to see that you're going to have 8 processors, and that's really going to make TextEdit fly for you.
Yeah, there's really no advantage. Although, if you use Make and you do a little -F9, boy, those things compile fast.
I'm sitting here looking at this screenshot. It looks like he took this right out of Activity Monitor, looking at all these. And, I'm just thinking FFmpegX. So it seems like your ripping capabilities can potentially go through the roof.
Well, but as he pointed out, where you start to really see, now you're going to see the bottlenecks in terms of throughput on the hard drive, throughput from the optical drives, even probably memory bottlenecks as well.
You would ask him about the fact that OS X seems like straight out of the box is ready for this. Do you have a sense of like how much this would affect other components? Is this going to put any kind of an extra, drag on other pieces? Is this a lot of heat?
That's one of the reasons these are slower clock speeds. These chips are a lot cooler. One of the reasons actually I upgraded the Mac Pro is because my dual G5, you can hear it. You can probably hear it is laboring. The thing has 9 fans in it, and on a hot day, it gets pretty loud in here. And so for a studio, and I'm sure, Scott, you probably have the same reasons. For a studio, a cooler
quieter machine is very desirable. Now, I don't. You go 8-way core. Suddenly, you might lose all the advantage you had. I don't know.
We switched to MacBook Pros for studio stuff, and they're just plenty fast enough.
And they're quiet.
Though they're whisper quiet.
Right, because they're laptops. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't hear anything from my MacBook Pro, despite all the rumors of whines and mooing and everything else.
No mooing.
Mine is quiet, and that's exactly what we use. And I do think this is very interesting, but. You know, faster computers make for lazy programmers, Leo.
That's why it's kind of a vicious circle is, you know, you get more RAM, more hard drive space, more processor. Eventually, you get no gain because everybody's just, you know, writing sloppy.
I want to predict that within 6 months, you're going to need these
eight of these
just to run Word. That's my prediction.
Microsoft. I used to write 6502 code into 4K of space. Yeah. We'd do a system walkthrough, and you had to justify every line of code. Right. Now the guys, he says, oh, the 8-year-old's got 4 gigs. Don't worry about it.
That's true. Our good friend Steve Gibson still writes in assembler language, and his stuff is like less than 100K. I don't know why. He doesn't have to.
Because it's cool. Because
he can. So we talked, and we've talked now, I think this will be the third MacBreak Weekly in a row we've talked about the iPod phone. The Economist had a very interesting article this week talking about and pretty much echoing what we've said all along, the difficulty in getting into the phone business. But they had an interesting thought that maybe Apple could become an MVNO. What's that, Merlin?
Yeah, that's a new term to me, but it's as you say in this Economist article, they're saying that this is basically a way where you, to quote them, you're leasing network capacity. So you're kind of going to be your own provider.
Disney did this. I think they are doing it right now.
That's right. They said that they're doing it for ESPN, and it has not been a breakaway success. But, you know, it's so funny. I mean, like with the iPods, you know, you can go out and buy a little commodity iPod for, gosh, I don't know. They're going to be given away in Cheerios boxes pretty soon. And yeah, obviously you have the iTunes offering that's associated with that that works so well with it. It's just interesting to think about the way the model seems to work right now is you've got a provider like Sprint or Verizon, whoever, and in some cases they're just giving these phones away. And so how do you change the equation for that? Is Steve going to be willing to partner up with some outside company and entrust that?
It seems like Apple's got a couple of choices. Either they charge $800 for the phone, which is often what you would pay if you bought a phone without getting a wireless plan. Does he bite the bullet and allow Motorola or somebody else to kind of dictate what that phone looks like and get a rocker? Or does he go to a phone company, a Sprint or a Singular or a T-Mobile, and say, okay, we'll work with you, but... you know, you got to give us final say. Or is there a fourth option? Maybe, you know, hey, he's the number one Disney shareholder. He certainly has a close up on what Disney's doing as a MVNO. Maybe he'll choose that. Scott Boyne.
I don't see them partnering with somebody externally.
I can't see it.
Because what that means is, I mean, that's along the lines of, again, let's go back to the iPod. You know, they're selling these, the DRM files, the AAC files, but you can put MP3s on there. Ditto here. They don't want anybody to say, well, you can't buy an iPhone because you have a contract with Verizon. Or whatever.
Scott, you say they have to do it because you want them to do it.
I really want it, and that's simply enough. And yes, I would pay $800.
You know what? So would I.
To get one. Because here's the deal. I've got, you know, you and I sat next to each other during the keynote at Macworld, Leo, and I was trying to figure out how to use my Trio 650 to take a picture of us, and I still can't make that thing sync to my Mac properly. Yep. No matter what I do, I am sick to death of not being able to talk to my computer with my cell phone. So yes, I would pay $800. Don't tell Steve Jobs. I would pay $1,800.
No,
I would in a heartbeat. Well, but if it really worked.
Are there a lot of people like you?
No, thank God.
But there probably are a lot of pretty serious Mac users who would pay, you know, full price. You know, I bought a chocolate for $400 or $500 for, you know,
Here's the way it works. You have this already happening in lots of places. I'm involved in an internet company that sells bandwidth that they lease from phone carriers. This is a fairly common practice. I can see Apple basically not building the network because we all agree that that's a really rough piece of this pie, but they could build the phone and they could build the add-on service, simply lease the network, provide a piece of the action to the company that's the backbone. I see that as actually doable.
I'm curious, though, for you guys. It sounds like you both are pretty excited, Scott in particular, about having this. What's the is it syncing? Is syncing the killer feature?
Sounds and like for Scott, that's what he wants.
But I mean, that I guess when you say what constitutes an iPhone for you? So for me, that would be syncing. That would be a ability to use Sailing Clicker. You know, all the stuff that I see out there that people with Ericssons can do, and with Sprint, I'm hobbled to like a very minor subset of what you can do with things like Bluetooth. So I'm guessing, are you saying syncing? You're saying full Bluetooth capabilities? When you say iPhone, what does that mean to you?
Well, that's actually a good point, because Scott, you know, a lot of what, let's just say if we get the sync software working, I use Sailing Clicker on my Windows Mobile 5 device. It works fine. The syncing kind of works. I mean, it works pretty well using Missing Sync. There's got to be more to it than that. Those things are just little fixes.
I agree. I definitely am very into trying to find ways to sync, not because of the syncing itself, but because I want all the great functionality that makes me a Mac user available to me on my mobile device.
A more Mac-ish phone?
Yeah, I want everything Mac, and here's what I know about Apple. Oh, despite the fact that they make me angry sometimes, I love the way that they end up doing things, and right. iTunes Store is a great example. Looking at the iPod and the iTunes Store, those are great successes because Apple figures out how to make it work. I can guarantee you, if they ever did a phone, and we don't know that they will, but if they ever did, it would just be as successful as the iPod and the iTunes Store, because they'd find some way to make that value add work, and then you can actually really enjoy your calendar program and all that.
To me, it starts with the iPod. The iPod is the device. From Apple's point of view, it's the device. People are saying, what people want, what I want is an iPod with phone capabilities. It starts with the iPod, don't you think, Merlin?
Yeah, I do think that. One interesting way to think of this, I mean, I haven't made a big deal about this because, you know, I'm still kind of getting my sea legs, but I've got a Trio. I got a Trio 700 Palm, and I'm really still getting my sea legs with this, with all the functionality of it. Versus other Sprint phones I've used probably six different Sprint phones now, and this is far and away the best experience. It's still not up to the point of using the little clicker wheel on my iPod. Right. There's still such a don't get me started on Sprint and how disjointed all their little Java apps are, and they don't talk to each other. I mean, the thing is, I've been evaluating these, like a lot of people, for the Sprint Ambassador program where you get these free phones. And the hang up for all of these things is you've got these little weird functional alcoves that just you have to enter into this little area to do a thing. So if I want to listen,
everyone is different.
And I can't bring, there's no way to bring my contacts in. Because I'm on a Mac. Right. So I have 700. Actually, right now I've got about close to 1,000 contacts I'd love to have in there.
Well, see, I've been able to sync my address book, no problem at all, to Windows Mobile 5.
Well, no, with the Trio, yes. But right now I'm looking at this, what is it, the LG Luzik, it's a great little phone. It's a great size. It's, as music player phones go, I think it's pretty good so far in the week I've been using it. But I mean, but here's, I think what we're, at the heart of it is, like Scott said, we want a Mac experience, we want an Apple experience. And so I want the whole interface for this thing to work together and be integrated. For me, to like little things like having more of a sense of state, you know, after the multi-finder, we got used to the idea that you're in an application, you go somewhere, and when you come back, it remembers what you were doing, right? That seems like the most obvious thing in the world. If I want to change to a different app on my Trio, I got to go back and start over. If I want to copy something and paste it. And so really, to me, one thing they could do if they were going to do a phone is to add something like a slightly finder-like capability that has a sense of state of where you, I don't know if that's
the
term
for it. I'm going to go one step farther. I think really what I'm hearing is we're just dissatisfied with the way cell phones are right now. We want somebody to do a better cell phone, and it just seems like Apple should be able to do a better cell phone.
Amen.
I mean, that's really it, right? It's just cell phone operating systems are crap.
Cell phones suck.
Well, you know, every time I use a cell phone, I see it as a very costly collection of business relationships that I'm paying for.
Yes.
I see a lot of business development happening. I see something that was relatively easy to build and it's not user centered in any way.
Yeah, the biz dev phone. No, you hit the nail on the head there. Speaking of business, some good business being done in the iTunes movie store. You know, I didn't notice this, but they changed the name of iTunes music store to just the iTunes store to accommodate the fact that they're selling movies, and a lot of movies, 125,000 downloads worth $1 million in the first week.
Yeah, I guess that was a real smart decision by all those other studios to sit it out, Leo. They're really making their board members happy. Hey, stockholders, we don't want any of that $1 million. No.
Well, I guess the question is that number going to go up or down in week two?
It's probably going to stabilize, but then I see gradually it going up as people get it, you know, get into adopting this new technology. Now, I got to tell you, I still stick by my original prediction. It's kind of a yawn for me personally. The price point is simply too high to make me want to do it, but I can see a lot.
Show of hands. Has anybody bought any movies yet?
I buy so much stuff on the iTunes store. It's ridiculous. I don't think I bought any movies yet. I have been buying TV shows. I mean, I guess I disagree with Scott a little bit because I see this as being very much for people like me, or it's an impulse buy.
Impulse.
I mean, again, for me, this keeps coming down to these decision-making buying points, and one of those is sitting in the airport on Wi-Fi, yeah. And you got 45 minutes till your flight starts. And I don't know if that's enough time to download a whole movie, but for me, grabbing that content and having it on the go is worth that cash, you know, and to not have to deal with Handbrake or whatever it is that, you know, to make that happen. So I don't know. I don't know if it's going to – I'm terrible at these kinds of predictions, but I suspect it'll level out. And then as people's comfort level with it gets more familiar and is – you know, and who knows? Maybe in the inside of a Mountain Dew cap, you know, next week you'll have a free download.
Movie.
You know, that's all it is. It's all this stuff. What did Napster ultimately teach us? It taught us that once you get people into the habit of being able to have things as soon as they want it, the business model will happen around that habit. And as much as all those companies, you know, moaned about, you know, how that was going to be the end of the world, you know, we're right back to Sony and the VCR in the 70s. You know, it's, you know, or Disney and the VCR in the 70s. But now that's the single biggest source of income for these companies. So, you know, they eventually find a way to make money off of it, and they eventually find a price point that works for a while. And I think that's going to happen in the next probably 6 months to a year.
Scott, you haven't bought anything on there and don't intend to.
I buy lots of stuff at the iTunes store, just no movies.
Right.
I downloaded my free copy of the Blade television pilot.
Oh, what'd you think?
I thought it was very interesting and very fun. But, you know, here's the thing, Leo. I've got like a 50-inch high-definition TV connected to a $10,000 THX-certified receiver. I'm not going to watch any movies on my MacBook Pro, thank you.
You might want to give out your address, Scott, just to make it a little easier for people. That way they won't have to Google you.
Yeah. How do we get that? I want that.
I don't have a $10,000. I have nothing. I have basically a room full of pit bulls and some rusty barbed wire and a very old transistor radio. That's all I've got.
I'm actually, in all seriousness, not because I'm trying to avoid burglary like Mr. Hot Dogs Ladies here is, but and we will be giving out his address later on, unless he says the special word,
banana.
Safe word.
there is
your safe word is banana.
Our safe word for the show is banana. If you should hear any host yell banana at any time,
you missed something really good after that.
Immediately cease listening for the next 10 seconds. Or what? What should they do if they hear the signal?
I cut you off, Scott. You've got a big ass TV. And you were saying you've got a big ass TV, and maybe you should just leave a dolly by it to make it easier for people to carry it out.
No, here's the deal.
But you get lots of pixelation. It just looks like crap.
I just would rather, you know, I can walk 8 steps from I was on Twim the other day talking about this. I can walk 8 steps from my Barco lounger and drop a DVD that I got from Netflix for the equivalent of about $1 into my $80
DVD player. I don't think it's mutually
player.
Exclusive, though.
I don't either.
You're,
I totally
you're
don't.
You're unusual, Scott, because you have very high quality components. I don't. I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I download TV shows. I download movies. I also watch. I mean, I have a 5-disc Netflix subscription, and I still download this stuff.
I've got box sets of music, but that doesn't stop me from buying a Tammy Wynette cassette when I'm on a road trip because I just want something to listen to.
I think it's very interesting, and I think younger people in particular who have maybe not had the experience that I have of, you know, coming up with media to put in their hands will be more inclined to do it. I believe me, I'm not dissing it. I think it's very cool because it really says 2 to 3, 4, 5 years from now things will change, and that's when I'll probably get excited. Just not, at this price point, I'm not probably going to be a player. I'm going to stick with what I got. And, you know, I'm old. I'm supposed to do things that way.
So with that nice AV setup, do you have a Sonos?
No, I don't.
Oh, boy. I covet these. Do you have one, Merlin?
No, I would like to make it very clear that as much as my morals and ethics are in line, I would be very happy to receive a free Sonos for testing purposes.
So you were saying that they're apparently giving them out, Mark?
I heard from a little bird that that Sonoses are available to people, and I would just like to say the Sonos product would
it's
be
a fine product.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got this right off Boing Boing yesterday, and it looked from what Mark is saying on Boing Boing, it looks like now, and again, I haven't followed this, so this might be old news, but the ability now to run Rhapsody over your Sonos system. So do you want to explain Sonos to people who don't
know? Yeah, we actually have reviewed it on Call for Help, and it's beautiful. I mean, there are a lot of devices that do this. They're wireless devices that take the content, in this case, just music, that's on your computer, and then send it to your stereo system. And the Sonos has the capability of they have powered speakers, so you could put speakers all over the house. Each speaker system can play different songs, so it's not like you have one unified system. They have perhaps the best-looking, easiest-to-use iPod-similar remote on the market. They're also expensive. The base kit is $1,000.
Really expensive.
But if you have a very, you know, if you're a very high-end AV kind of guy, this is, or gal, this is, you know, clearly the one you want.
Does it work with iTunes, Leo?
It does.
Well, I'll be having one tomorrow.
Well, and talk about your reverse Polaroid model. I mean, if you can drop a grand on this thing, you then go ahead and pay your $10 a month for Rhapsody and have access to a bajillion songs. You can stream, apparently, tell me if this is true, Leo, but you can stream different songs to different rooms.
That's right. Now, I don't know if that would work with Rhapsody. You can do it with stuff on your hard drive.
Okay.
I'm not sure how that would work with Rhapsody. I'll be honest with you. I don't really care about Rhapsody. I wanted to support Pandora. The slim devices supports Pandora. It's very similar, less expensive. You like Pandora, don't you? I heard you were a Pandora fan.
Me?
Yeah.
I've played with it a little bit. I played like with that in Last FM.
I'd rather have it support that than Rhapsody.
That's kind of an interesting idea. I mean, you know, the neat thing about Rhapsody is it's kind of the ultimate, you know, you're up late and having drinks and you want to hear, you know, right. Lonely Boy by Andrew Gold and it's right there, you know.
Jeez, you really? You get drunk and you want to hear Lonely Boy?
Banana. Banana.
Okay. I'm thinking more like it's 2:45. There's no one in the place except me and Lonely Boy.
But Scott, is there a place for anything like this in your life? It sounds like you've got your own kind of standard media. You're out there buying plastic discs and stuff. So there would be no place for this in your
life. Well, you know, I'm 52 years old, and I value a good old-fashioned vinyl LP. There's nothing like a vinyl LP if you want to listen to music.
And they had music when you were younger?
Vinyl. They did.
Vinyl.
Wow.
And I got to tell you that I do kind of use the old method, but now, here's the thing. When I travel, I am pretty much based in my MacBook Pro, and I have a lot of iTunes Music Store music that I've purchased. Unlike everybody else that buys CDs and rips them, I actually have bought quite a lot of music from the iTunes Store, and I buy a lot of audiobooks from the iTunes Store. And those are things that I've sort of gravitated to, but I'm very interested in all this stuff. It's just that, you know, I'm old-fashioned, and it takes me a while to get to it. And plus, Merlin, keep in mind, you're being at least a decade younger than me, they market to you. They don't market to me, so I don't hear about this stuff.
I think actually the Sonos is really aimed at rich folk like you. I don't think it's aimed at the younger crowd.
I am not rich.
I just play a rich man on the podcast.
Excuse me while I change my monocle.
I'm sorry there. Another martini, please.
$100 speaker system
in
my
head. What I would do, I would... If I had a, you know, if I'm thinking like, you know, you got your office full of 10 or 15 people and, you know, it's kind of still a pain in the butt to, I mean, unless you're kind of have the hacky mindset, it's not the easiest thing in the world to share libraries and have a music system that everybody can have access to. This seems to me like the kind
that
of thing
solves that
for
problem.
An office.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I do know offices that use this and love it a lot. But again, it's $1,000 just to get started. And I think that is actually a pretty prohibitive price point for most people.
If it works with iTunes, I'm interested in it.
All right. We'll get you a unit. We'll call Mark Fraunfelder and see what he can do.
There's only one way to find out, Sonos.
See, if they would let me have one, this would be the perfect proof that anyone could use it, because an old geezer like me can hook it up.
Hey, they took ours back from Call for Help, so I don't know anything
Uh-oh.
About it. First details, Office 2007 for the Mac. We've been hearing a lot about Office 2007 for Windows. It's got the new Vista interface. Apparently an all-new UI for Mac users, too. I know, Merlin, you write a lot. I'd be surprised. Do you use Office?
Well, you know, I got to say, I love Excel. I mean,
really?
To me, to me, Excel is like one of the all-time great programs. Excel is, you know, you're basically exposing a UI for a database.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree. It's very powerful. I'm just surprised that you use it.
Well, now having said that, I write everything in TextMate. You're a TextMate fan as well,
I love
right?
TextMate, yeah.
So, I mean, I write everything in text files.
And I use Keynote, not PowerPoint, but I have to say there is no
compatible. You know, there's no comparable spreadsheet.
See, but here's the problem. I mean, if you're going to, like, I learned early on when I was, you know, trying to write my godforsaken book for O'Reilly, I, you know, there's no way of getting away from Word.
By the way, that's,
you know,
the name
if you're
of the
doing...
book, my godforsaken book.
Still not available at your bookstore. But the fact of the matter is, if you deal with the rest of the world, there's, you know, text edit will only take you so far. I love just being able to open stuff in text edit.
Yeah,
but there are certain things you got to have Word for. It's like, you know what, to me, it's like the software equivalent of owning a fax machine. Like, I need it just often enough to be incredibly annoying.
How about you, Scott? Do you use it?
I use Nisus Writer Express.
Me too. I'm a Nisus fan. I like
Nisus. Nisus, however it is.
Yeah.
But I just want to piggyback on top of Merlin's last comment, because that's where I'm at. I deal with a lot of people that send me stuff as
you
Word docs.
You
kind of
have to have it, don't you?
So I do have the full Microsoft suite on my computer.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it comes to presentations, I'm 100% tried and true Keynote guy.
Me too.
And, you know, I prefer the Nisus product. And, you know, I'm excited about the new Word, though, because if they've done a better job of working with the Mac interface and can make things a little smoother, I'm a fan if it works.
It's going to do something kind of like the ribbon on Office 2007 for Windows. That's the new Microsoft look. To me, the most important thing is it's universal.
Absolutely.
Which Office is not right now.
Yeah, it's slow. It's really slow on my MacBook Pro.
Yeah. They say sometime between July and September of next year. So it's a while. This isn't going to happen right away.
So in other words, about 24 months before Vista releases.
Yeah, right. We shall see. We've got a Vista podcast launching on Friday. So, and I was, you know, at first I was going to call it Countdown to Vista, and I thought, but then Vista will come out, we'd have to change the name. And then I realized, but by then I'll be dead. So we're just going to call it Countdown to Vista, I think. We'll start at 1,999, 998.
Yeah, that's going to be episode 23,265.
Yeah, we have to change our name.
So, hi, I'm Leo Laporte Jr. We're all about Vista.
My son is getting ready. He's training up. He's at 12 now. By the time it comes out, he should be my age. Let's see, what else? Bootcamp 1.1, a little trouble with the 24-inch iMac. Is that true? That's kind of disappointing.
It's not my area. I don't want to put Windows on my Mac.
Yeah, I haven't tried this. I don't have the Mac to try this on. It was just something that a few people were talking about over on the Apple board. This is a link that comes in via Dig. And I don't know if it's accurate. It sure sounds like that's
people's
experience.
Parallels. I'm just so happy with Parallels that I kind of haven't tried Bootcamp since it first came out. But boy, you'd think on the 24-inch iMac is just made to do both Mac and Windows. You know,
isn't this something that they're kind of selling in the ads? I mean,
interesting, because the ads, once they were selling Run Windows, but they started pushing Parallels, not Bootcamp. So I don't know.
I think what they're saying also is that because Bootcamp is technically beta, it's not supported. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think that might be the case as well. So you know, we'll leave that still up in the air. I do have my neighbor kid, who's a Windows user for life, because he plays games, so shocked the heck out of me. He just bought a 24-inch or 20-inch iMac because of the Core 2 and because he could run Bootcamp. So he's going to be a little disappointed if he can't. YouTube showing that maybe it will survive. You know, one of the problems YouTube has is they spend over $1 million a month in bandwidth. How do you monetize that? You make a deal with Warner Music. You're going to start seeing music videos from Warner's artists like Madonna, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Sean Paul on YouTube. A great way to promote music.
It absolutely is. I mean, the message of so much of this stuff seems to be, you know, why not let some willing person pay the freight on getting this stuff out there? And the communities that build up around this stuff are just fantastic.
Yeah, I like that business model. And you know, my only concern for YouTube is how they're going to deal with all the copyright lawsuits they get from the people that aren't part of the deal.
You know, it's funny. We had Steve Chen from YouTube. Amber was one of the early proponents of YouTube over a year ago. And we had Steve on in March on Inside the Net. And the real concern when we had him on then was not how do you pay for the bandwidth, because it wasn't that huge yet. It was how are you going to survive the copyright lawsuits? They've somehow managed to dodge that bullet all this time. And now all the talk is really, well, what's your burn rate? How much is it costing you? You know, 100 million videos a day being served. In fact, Merlin, look what you're doing with your Vox blog. It's all links to YouTube.
Yeah, that's it. I think it's kind of interesting. Any of these, the reason I thought this would be fun to talk about on the Mac one is just, again, thinking about this whole idea. We talked last week a little bit about iTunes and how it could be made a little bit more into something like Democracy, and a program that goes out there and finds this stuff for you. I mean, one thing I love about YouTube and Democracy for that matter is I can just go point it at something that I'm interested in. I know I said this last week, but I think this is a point not to be missed. You know, to be able to go out there and point it at something I'm interested in. This is, go find me stuff about whatever, Madonna. And it's going to pull that stuff in for me automatically. It just seems like more and more this is going to be
a great model, boy. I think that's a great model for them.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, capitalizes, networks, and it's a business use companies? For RSS.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then it always was an issue for me with YouTube was they make it so easy to link that many people will watch, I don't know how many of their videos are watched not even from the YouTube site, but from people's blogs where there's no chance to monetize unless they do a pre-roll ad or something.
Well, there's probably, like they say, I'll go into my 1998 mode for a minute, but I mean, there's probably not room for five players in this space, but to become the Google
the
of video.
Yeah, the guy, right.
Let me drill down on this. What I want to do is open the kimono. Net, we need to capture eyeballs. Listen,
whoa,
seriously, between
us. I
just
felt like we went back in time 7 years. That was amazing.
Well, listen, Leo, we don't want to boil the ocean. Really, at the end of the day, but
I just know, like, but at the end of the day, that's all you have to say. It's over at the end of the day. It's a profit deal at the end of the day.
At the end of the day, net. Yeah. Net. But the reason I mentioned that is I don't know. I just think it's interesting to think about. There's so many directions now. It's so clear that iTunes is going to become this hub of activity for the way you think about media and the way you do that stuff. I don't know. I just thought it was kind of an interesting kind of, related story.
You think YouTube is a natural competitor to iTunes?
Well, see, I don't know if they're competitors. One thing, gosh, we're still so much in this mindset of you go somewhere on the internet and do this thing, And I know I get 10 pitches a week from people who want me to create a 15th community blog,
right,
or 15th community. You know what I mean? And so to me,
I think
some
people
of the fascinating.
Are tired of you hit the nail on the head. They're tired of going places.
Well, they are. And I mean, the phrase that I've started using for this stuff is what I call, kind of like functional spackle, things where you're using, technologies like APIs and XML RPC to make the stuff all kind of work together. And so, I don't know, I just think it's kind of fascinating to think about, the ways that these apps can interact with each other. And, who knows? I mean, nobody in the early days probably thought Google was going to be making all their money off of ads. They thought, well, they'll pay for placement or what have you. I don't know. I just think there's still a lot of interesting models that can happen with this stuff. And there's no telling what, where it's going to end up.
One last. Go ahead.
Let me just bring in a little perspective of an old man, though.
The old rich man speaks.
Would you stop with the rich?
We're just going to call you Thurston. What is it, Thurston?
Just because I have a nice TV does not mean I'm rich.
You okay. Sound like a rich, guilty guy to me, Scott.
Yeah.
Listen.
I give lots of money to people.
Oh, I do. No,
you
I'm sorry, Scott. We're just teasing you. Go ahead.
I want this edited out, Leo.
Banana.
Okay. I remember a little company because I signed one of the first deals with them called Pointcast. Anybody remember Pointcast?
And they were huge at the time. In fact,
let me just remind everybody that Adam Curry is not the podfather. I'm the podfather because I delivered the first streaming media
via
Pointcast.
Did you do audio on Pointcast?
We were Net Radio did the first deal with them.
Interesting. Really?
And so we were doing podcasting 12 years ago.
Pointcast was so successful that for a while the entire internet would slow down at 9 in the morning when everybody got to the office, flipped on their machines, and Pointcast started downloading the megabytes of crap.
Is that an urban myth? Because I had heard that that same thing, that along the lines of the Super Bowl toilet flushing, that's something like so many minutes.
It's not an urban myth. In
really?
Fact, I worked in an office where that was a real problem, and they had to start banning Pointcast. I think Ziff Davis wide, they had to start banning Pointcast for that very reason. Their servers would get slammed when people came into work in the morning, because that's how Pointcast was set up. It was impolite. It would just start downloading the minute it was turned on.
And I just want to point out that this is really... Merlin's bringing this problem up. Everybody wants stuff delivered to him. Well, we tried to deliver it to him 12 years ago. And I think that RSS is a much better implementation than what Pointcast was trying to do. But these things go in cycles, and I don't know that it's a permanent response to say people want stuff delivered to them. I think we're going
to
see that.
I do have to say, though, that it's to go from site to site to site to site to get each of these little features, or not just news hits, but now I have a lot of Web 2.0 applications, Google Spreadsheet and FreshBooks for my billing, and it's getting a little annoying, frankly.
Yeah, and I mean, so I don't disagree really with what you're saying, Scott. I think the problem, not the problem, but the interesting thing to notice is that everybody focuses so heavily on, you know, what the newest shiny widget is and what the business model for that is. And to me, the thing that's interesting to watch is how people's habits evolve. You know, to me, of course, this is straight, you know, out of the kind of 43 folder stuff that we talk about. But I think the thing to watch is what people do habitually. And even if there's not a business model directly associated with YouTube today, to think about the fact that people are getting used to the idea of being able to get video on demand and then take it any place. To me, that's the really interesting thing here. And this, in the same way that iTunes lets me go and download the first season of Law and Order, you know, that's the pattern to watch to me. It's not who got funded for what. It's where these habits as consumers are starting to group.
By the way, Merlin, that's only on 73 times a night in reruns on every channel.
The first season. I'm talking George Zunda years.
The good, the really good years.
Yeah, what night of the sold
week,
out.
What night of the week is Law & Order not on 53 channels? That's what I
You know what's great, though, is with your big screen, you can actually watch seven episodes at once.
Same
and not
time.
Miss anything. Yeah.
Can I make a confession? I've never seen Law & Order.
Oh, be thankful. Don't be that guy.
I am that guy. I've never seen any of this stuff.
I might listen to vinyl music, but you not knowing about Law & Order, that trumps my vinyl music.
You know, I remember L.A. Law. That's it for me. After that, it was all over. If it doesn't have Corbin Burnson in it, I don't want to see it.
Yeah, that's a rule here at our house. We just won't watch it if it doesn't have Corbin Burnson.
No.
Well, let's see what's on tonight. Well, how are we doing for Burnson content?
One last story, and then I do want to talk about the so-called hack that people have been talking about. It's been all the conversation since it was kind of revealed Friday in the Mac installer. But we wanted to mention quickly this retail update from Apple. Ron Johnson, who's Senior Vice President of Retail for Apple Computer, was speaking at a conference, and really kind of dramatic numbers here. Apple's going to open 40 new stores this year. 3,500 special events, 10,000 visitors each week on per store. That's up, by the way, from 9,000 the week before. The average revenue, this is the one blew me away, per store, $441,000 a week. They're doing very well. I'm one of the first people who said Apple should not open stores. That's a bad business. Look what happened to Gateway, and boy, was I wrong.
Right.
Well, their implementation is much better than Gateway, obviously. And I know some people that work up here in the Northwest with Costco, and they're really looking at those numbers from a take per square foot standpoint, and they're very envious because, you know, the unit prices at Apple stores are so much higher, obviously, because they're dealing with computers. And the people that have drawn that up and made it work are really heroes in the retailing world.
That's the number to look at, take per square foot, and it is right. Very high. They have each store averaging 6,000 square feet. 6,000 square foot store generates 66% of the business of a Best Buy, which is 38,000 square feet.
See, so that's the number that you really got to notice.
Very efficient.
And what do you think of that little thing he slid in about the quote-unquote entirely new store design?
Yeah, the Fifth Avenue store, I guess, is the inspiration, and that's pretty an amazing store. By the way, their 1 millionth visitor just recently. What do you think that would be? Glass elevators in all the stores?
You know, I noticed something kind of interesting. I mean, we have one at the mall that's just kind of right near my house. So if I ever need, you know, something, you know, super fast, like an iPod case or whatever, I can just jet down there. And I don't know. Have you guys noticed this? You guys have probably seen this too. They're very big. This is one of the smaller stores, right? This is not like the one on Stockton.
There's two kinds. There's big stores and there's the little mall
stores.
That's right. Yeah.
But in any case, at all of these, they seem like they're doing what they can to kind of reach out to the community. Like I go in there, if I go in there in the morning, there'll be like school kids there doing a computer camp.
That's what he said. They've sent 20,000 kids through their whatever it is, summer camp program. What a brilliant idea. Get kids used to Macs now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and just that whole idea. Well, but who drops kids off at the store?
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, maybe dad will pop by and just have a look at what those nanos look like.
If it's free computer classes, why not? Right.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, I just think that's kind of an interesting idea. And you look at what they do at Stockton. Actually, yeah, I saw you do the Twit podcast. That
yeah. I love
in that area, usually they're doing these demonstrations and showing people. And man, in the middle of course, it's San Francisco, so this is an outlier. But you go in there in the middle of the day, and there's frequently a bunch of people there, like learning how to do stuff with iPhone.
They say men don't like to shop. Anybody who says that hasn't been to an Apple store. It's full of shopping men. Right.
Well, in the 1940s, IBM had free typewriter clinics for young women so that they would get accustomed to using the typewriters and moving up into the secretarial pools that were so prominent back then. This is not a new idea. It's just a very good implementation of it. And I am a little bit saddened to hear that they are doing away with the theaters in the store design. Yeah, they are doing away with the theaters, which is actually one of the things I really liked about the store, but I guess I don't count.
It doesn't generate revenue, at least not right away.
It breaks into that cost per square foot, revenue per square foot model that they so much love.
I agree with you that that's too bad, because that's really what draws people into the store often is these presentations, and then afterwards they buy.
They're going to expand the Genius Bar, apparently, in response to removing the I'm still waiting for the first Genius to show up.
Yeah. I would like to see them expand the level of Genius that's available.
More geniuses!
buy a new computer does not count as Genius.
No. There is a pretty significant exploit that's being talked about on the Apple discussion boards and elsewhere. A malformed installer package could actually give a bad guy root access to a Macintosh, giving them the ability to do anything they want. Turns out this is nothing new. We talked with Adam Knight. He is the editor of a Mac blog called Mac Geekery at MacGeekery.com. And he actually described and demonstrated this whole and has some advice for you. Hi, Adam.
Hi there.
This is not anything new.
No. This has been around since the inception. Really?
And there's been, at least for 6 months, maybe more, there's been talk about this on the Apple forums, but Apple's not done anything about it.
Right. Well, I mean, it's one of those situations where it is almost a graphical bug. It could be considered that, but not really.
A graphical bug in what sense?
Well, there's three different security levels for an installer package. There's none, which it runs as you. There's root, which it runs as root, and there's admin, where curiously it runs as root, and that's our problem.
Before we go too much farther, and by the way, your blog is a great place for Mac security if people want to know more about it. What is the difference on a Mac between admin and root?
That's a very good question. So a Mac actually has three security levels. There's your average user, which has access to its home folder, can read everything else, really, but that's where you can change.
You've recommended it, and I do too, that's how you should be running.
Absolutely.
When you're in a Mac, any operating system, except Windows is hard to do it in, but any good operating system, you could run as a limited user, and that's the safest way to run.
Yes, because if anything takes control of your account, they can only do what you can do. If you prevent yourself from being able to do some of these things, then the scripts or worms or whatever else can't do it.
Right. Now, there's the admin account, which is what you always have to create when you first create a set up a OS X system. And that's right. That's the account that you go into or run as when you want to install stuff, modify system files, open your system preference panes, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's the one that has the authorization to actually change things on the computer.
And now, I always assumed that was root, but it's not.
It is and isn't. You see, so that's where the gem of this comes in. It is a normal user with the permission to become root with the proper credentials.
All right.
So the root user is what the system's going to be running as. You know, that's what the computer is. There's a security framework for Mac OS X programs that allows them to escalate their privileges legitimately to root by presenting that password dialog saying, who are you? Are you an admin user? And then it runs things as root afterwards.
That's the authenticate dialog that you see sometimes.
That's right. So whenever you want to do something...
I've seen this happen on the command line because I always run as a normal user. Mm-hmm. And you can't sudo. You know, a lot of times when you're doing stuff in terminal, you'll sudo to become root. And you can't sudo as a normal user. You have to first... SU to the admin user. You have to become the admin user, and then you can sudo after that.
That's right.
So that's the same thing here, that the programs that need root access are not allowed to escalate to root unless you, as an administrator, authorize it.
That's right.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's almost a three-step thing.
It is, and what makes a normal user an admin is merely the membership in the admin group.
Okay.
It is otherwise the same thing. So, being in that group lets it do it.
So that's the only thing different between a normal user and admin user is membership of the admin group.
That's right.
Okay.
So that's where this becomes a problem, however. So the authorization framework says, if you're in this group, I can let you become root. somehow Apple has said, well, if the package has this one flag saying admin rights and you're already an admin, we'll just go ahead and give you root without prompting.
Oh, all right.
So you download an installer package, it says it needs admin rights, exact same thing as root rights would have. Running the package as root, and including that, the shell scripts there inside of it, and installing in places the root can install to.
So even if you run this installer as a limited normal user, it will have root access?
If you run it as a regular user, that's your defense. Because you're not an admin, and it can't jump to root. That's the protection against it.
So it will then still have to ask you for your admin
precisely. Password. And it will require the admin password, not your account
password. But if you are running, as many people still do, which is really a shame, as an administrative user.
And I entirely blame Apple for that. Because when the system is installed, there's one user made, and that user is an admin user, and no mention of what that user can do is ever presented to the user in the name Simplicity.
Yeah, in fact, when you install Linux, in most cases, it'll create a root account, but it will also instruct you to create a normal user account and use that. They're very clear about that.
Right, and several of the installations I've done recently have forced you to go down to a regular user
with
no access.
Right. So, I mean, this is partly just getting the word out. It doesn't sound like there's is there a fix, you think, a patch that Apple should be making?
So there's two things you can do. I mean, today, go down to a normal user, and we have instructions on the site on how to do that. The other thing that Apple can do immediately to resolve this is to simply make the installer present the authentication dialog so that you know it wants elevated privileges for the file.
So people who write installers need to be doing this.
And they can't do that. Well, actually, they can. They can change that flag to use root privileges instead of admin privileges, and that'll present the dialog.
Okay, but so Apple could fix it, or an installer package author could, or the individual can do it and should be doing it. Because this escalation is, in fact, not the only kind of escalation that can happen. This was when we saw a kind of a sample exploit a few months ago. That's exactly how it worked as well, of a different exploit.
The thing I would warn, saying that the package author can change it, that's right, they can, but that's not going to solve the underlying problem, is that you can go to admin and get these privileges.
Right. Bad guy wasn't going to do it.
Exactly. So the bad guy, he wants to do this.
Right, right.
So what has to happen is either the user takes his fate in his own hands right now and moves himself down to a regular user, or Apple in some future release says both admin authorization and root authorization both give you a password dialog. That would be the real fix for now.
Right. So, and somebody points out on your blog that really it's not exactly a security issue in the sense that this is normal behavior. The issue really is that users shouldn't be running as administrators.
That's part of it. There is a security problem. There's two parts to it. The first is the users. Never run anything you don't know what it is. I mean,
really,
that's one of the fundamental things in security. Trust what you're going to do. The second is on Apple. Anytime a system escalates your privileges, it should require the user to input some sort of authorization.
Right, right.
If you go from normal user to root, it should prompt you and say, can you really do this?
Same thing as if you're running an administrator. If there's an escalation, it should ask.
Right, because again, the administrator is just a user that's a member of a certain group.
Right, right.
So they've chosen to get around that, and they should choose not to.
You have on your posting on MacGeekery.com, you have kind of an example of the exploit and a very clear description of how it works. But more importantly, and I would recommend people read this, you also describe how to stop running as administrator, how to do it right. Stop living in your admin account.
Right.
And it's not so hard to do. In fact, I did it the minute I heard about the exploit a few 6 months ago. I said, what am I doing running as an admin? And I changed all of my systems. And, you know, unlike Windows, where it's a real pain not to run as admin, it's absolutely easy as pie. The only time I get annoyed is when I want to change system preference settings. And I have to unlock that padlock. I have to authenticate. But that's as it should be.
Right. And after you unlock it, it behaves exactly as if you're the admin.
Right, right. That's as it should be. Well, I really appreciate your clarification of this, Adam, and I'm glad we could get you on Mac Break Weekly and get the word out. MacGeekery.com is the place to get your geek on. A community site for, you say moderate to advanced geekery, but I think anybody who uses a Mac could do well by reading your postings there. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Leo.
So I got a question for you, Scott and Merlin. Are you running as an administrator?
I don't run as administrator when I'm on my Wi-Fi network, but otherwise I do.
Merlin?
Not in 10 minutes from now.
You know, it's funny because it was about 6 months ago that this, I can't remember the name of this exploit. It was a theoretical exploit. And everybody said, oh, the first Mac exploit. And that was exactly what it said was if it only works if you're not running, if you're running as administrator, if you're not running as a limited user. So I immediately changed to a normal user on all my machines. And you know what? It's no problem at all. It's easy. Highly recommend.
And you're still typing your password in all the time anyhow, right?
You would be anyway, but this way you know that you're not escalated to root without at least.
Yeah, I mentioned this a couple episodes ago, but I think the problem for me is you kind of go numb to typing in the password.
Well, you have to be careful.
And you get so right. Yeah, exactly. You get so and you know, and you've got to hit the little reveal triangle, at least in my case. I don't know how yours is configured, but you need to hit a reveal triangle to pop down and see what process is asking for that permission.
Right.
I mean, you know, one thing that might be kind of handy, and this might be more hand holding than a lot of people want, but maybe to show you, like, you know, like for example, they added that thing in where the first time you launch an application, it lets you know that,
right.
You know,
that's
says,
nice.
Maybe something along those lines that says, wow, this is kind of extraordinary. This is a process that doesn't get used a lot.
Right.
You know what I mean? Just to kind of give you some sense of notification of what you're allowing.
At least for me, if I see that pop up and I'm not installing something or trying to open a system preference pane, and then I'm going to be suspicious. If it coincides with a time when I'd expect to see it, maybe that's where I'm numb. Maybe that would be a good time for somebody to slip in.
But it sounds like the way he's describing this exploit is part of the problem is you don't even need to do this password. It's something
right.
That
if you're a full user, an administrative user, and you run this installer. It will get root access whether you give it a password.
It's inherited by what you're looking. Yeah.
So I think that's very important, and I think people probably should take this as an indication that it's time to stop running as administrator day to day and start running as a normal user. Certainly, that's what I do, and it's totally doable. We have one more interview. This is going to be forever known as the interview Mac Break Weekly. This one's kind of important to the entire Mac community. Adam Christensen is on the horn, and this is kind of a last-minute edition of this week's Mac Break Weekly. Poor Adam had kind of a problem on Monday, and the problem has persisted all week. If you are a fan of MacCast, as we all are, you might have noticed no MacCast for a while. Posts, though, at his blog explains why. Is that a new blog for you? I hadn't seen that site before.
No, it's just another site that I ended up having to emergency sort of redirect everything to because, you know, I was shut down by the hosting company and I didn't have any way to communicate to my audience. This actually happened on Wednesday morning.
Wednesday,
as near, okay. Yeah, as near as I can tell, about 9 a.m., I think, Pacific time. The problem kind of started about 5 a.m. that morning, I guess.
What happened?
Too many people visiting the site, and now I'm coming to realize that it may have been a dig effect. So I may have Kevin to thank.
he's been dugged, hoist by his own success. So
yeah, exactly.
Here's the thing that was surprising. This actually is a kind of a word of warning to all podcasters or anybody putting up a site where you might get a lot of traffic all of a sudden. You had a lot of bandwidth, 2 terabytes of bandwidth,
right?
Which was more than enough.
200 gigabytes of storage.
Plenty of storage.
More than enough, yeah.
And you thought, well, hey, what can happen? As long as I monitor that, I should stay online.
Right, right. And that was, you know, I told my listeners that I think I was a little naive in this space, thinking that that's what I was buying. I knew I was on a shared hosting account. I think it's no secret that my hosting company right now is GoDaddy. And they've been great. I've had them since January. The service has been absolutely fabulous. Like you said, I monitored the bandwidth very, very closely. I kept an eye on it, but I was only, pulling, I don't host my MP3 files there. I use Libsyn for that, who are fabulous.
So the bandwidth wasn't coming off of the podcast download.
Not at all. It was simply a fact of I have my WordPress blog hosted there. I do have my, I run a pretty popular forum there, but like I said, for since January, I've had no issues whatsoever. It's been running just great, and I haven't had any huge spikes in bandwidth. I mean, there's been steady growth, but again, I wasn't reaching anywhere near my 2 terabyte a month limit. I mean, not even close. I think last I checked, I was doing about 150 gigabytes a month.
So you're well below your limit. So what happened?
Yeah. So like I said, I think I've come to find out that what I started to do is I recently brought on some guys to help bring up the content on my website. So the podcast has been going great, and that's been fabulous. And my bulletin board has been hugely successful. And so I just was kind of adding to the things I was trying to do for my listeners and for, you know, the Mac community. And so I thought, well, you know, I want to start posting some more articles and reviews and things like that. So I got together a team of volunteers, and they started posting last week. And I guess one of the posts got picked up on Dig. And then it was just like an influx. That one morning, the traffic to the website about quadrupled. So it went up, it instantly spiked. And I guess GoDaddy had a problem with that. It was affecting other people on the shared server. So it's probably worth explaining to everybody kind of how shared servers work, because that seems to be where the issue lies.
Yeah, it's in fact very common if you get a low-cost hosting plan that you may be on the same physical hardware as hundreds, maybe sometimes even thousands of other websites. And of course, that makes sense. Most websites don't pull much bandwidth. It works pretty well until you become popular. Then right. You're sucking all the CPU, all the bandwidth, all the horsepower that one machine has.
Right. And so my thing is, it, as an industry, it seems like this isn't really talked about. So they say you have this much a month, but it really comes to down to you're sort of allocated, I think, so much per hour, per minute. I don't know how they absolutely do it. I haven't really gotten the answer on that. But I mean, if you spike out in a given period of time, and even if it's intermittent, like this only lasted for a couple hours, but they just saw the problem. They go in and look at the server. They go, well, it's this website. And their immediate reaction is, Right. Shut it off. We got to shut it off.
That's because all of the other websites that are on your same hardware are, in fact, down or slowed greatly.
Right. And I absolutely understand that. What I sort of took issue with GoDaddy on in their handling of the situation is I found out about it. So they shut it down about 9. I probably found out about it about 10 when I got up and started checking my email. And then I had to call them and say, what's going on? My site's down.
Yeah.
And then they told me about the problem. So, yeah, there was no notification. There was not even immediately after. And I've since now obviously been in contact with GoDaddy, and they explained that there was a failure on their end. At least that's what they're telling me at this time, that's not their normal procedure, that I should have been contacted immediately after the shutdown. They said there was nothing they could do to do it prior to the shutdown, which is how I would really like to see things in the industry operate.
Must be something automated.
Yeah. Well, no, they said it was a physical person who did it, and that it was just a new person and he didn't follow the procedure. So that's the story I've been given so far.
Well, it's very embarrassing for GoDaddy, who, by the way, you know, is trying to reach out to podcasters and certainly has its own podcast and sponsors a lot of podcasts. Do they sponsor MacCast?
No, they don't.
And I guess they never will at this point. So, but you're staying on GoDaddy
for the time being. So immediately what I did, as you noted, was it took me a while to figure out, because my main stress when this happened was, how do I get to my audience? How do I tell everybody what's going on?
Because right now no podcasts are going out. People can't find your podcast.
Right.
We should explain that even though you're hosted on Libsyn, your RSS feed, which is kind of critical to the podcast, apparently was coming from GoDaddy.
Yeah, the RSS feeds are on GoDaddy. Right. So I had no way to get a podcast out. I had no way to get even a web page out. So I, for some reason, it just clicked in my head, well, I can domain forward my domain to another site and at least get a page up. So I put that page up, and then that is sort of triggered this sequence of events where I think that got picked up on Dig, and there was a lot of news, and I guess people were sending emails to GoDaddy. So lo and behold, GoDaddy, of course, emailed me directly. The VP of technology. I got a personal email, and they have been very helpful. Now, I want to stress that, you know, through the whole process, I initially called customer service, and GoDaddy's customer service has been fabulous. You know, they were really tied by their policies. There wasn't much they could do for me. I mean, they, like you pointed out, need to protect all of their customers, not just one customer. And I fully recognize that. And I'm just trying to be very clear with my audience and with everybody that this is not just a GoDaddy problem. How they handled it maybe was not the best, and they promote themselves as being sort of above the rest, and so that's what I'm taking issue with. But this happens, and I've talked to other podcasters and bloggers, and I'm finding out that tons of people have this happen to them every single day.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we've been on Twit's been on dedicated servers since day one because for that very reason. We have three full-time servers because it's the only way you can guarantee bandwidth, guarantee uptime.
Yeah.
And I think at some point you're going to have to spend the money to do that. But there are a lot of people who have $5 hosting plans, and that's, boy, if it's, you're paying $5 a month or $6 or $10, you're shared for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And so I think it's good now that we can kind of get the word out to people because, I mean, there's a lot more bloggers out there, and all right. It's going to take is, you know, one thing on Dig, and this could happen to you without warning, without notification. And now I understand. So I'm moving to a dedicated server right now. It's GoDaddy because they're helping. They actually are migrating it for me. Yeah.
We use a company called The Planet, which I've been very happy with. But it's $250 a server, so it's a month. It's expensive. It's a lot more expensive.
Yeah, like I said, my hosting costs just went up 900%.
Yep. It's exactly right. Well, Mattcast is a great podcast. Everybody knows I love it, and I've been on it, and Adam's always been one of the earliest podcasters, a proto podcaster, and a great guy. And so I was really distressed when I saw what happened, and I'm glad we could get you on to let the world know. Maccast.com is up, and yes. Your feeds are working, and the Maccast is out.
Yeah, we're gonna stay up. Everything's on dedicated, and you know, I'll be shopping around, but for now, GoDaddy's been great, and they've helped me get over and back up and running. Okay. So it's good news.
Thank you, Adam. And sometime you got to come by and join Mac Break Weekly. We'd love to have you on the panel.
Anytime. Give me a call.
I'll give you a call. We'll see you at Podcast Expo.
All right.
Take care. That's Adam Christensen of Maccast, maccast.com. He's going to be back up and actually is up and running right now. Before we get back to our regular panel and their picks of the week, just a reminder that this podcast, as all the Twit podcasts in the month of September, has been brought to you by Visa. Visa has been very helpful in supporting the podcasts. They want to get the word out that Visa is a better way to buy online. I certainly agree with their fraud protection, their constant monitoring, their double guarantee that you're not going to have a problem if you use your Visa card online. It just gives you that safe peace of mind. Visa, safer, better money. Life and Twit takes Visa. Before we go, Scott Bourne, what are you working on? Anything interesting, an application that you're interested in, something new coming down the pipe? A heads up about anything?
Well, I've just been thoroughly enjoying the new iTunes Music Store, which is no longer called the Music Store, which is just now called the iTunes Store. And I discovered something quite by accident. Do you know that if it's because of the way my keyboard's configured, I was kind of leaning on my keyboard, and I accidentally leaned on the Alt key while launching iTunes. And guess what? You can now select which folder you want your iTunes library to be.
Oh, automatically.
Wow. But if you hold down the when you're starting, if you hold down the Alt key, or the Option key, I guess.
Create
the
library, option, choose option library. So you could choose a different library every time you launch.
Yes, and I thought, man, now that's
a good
cool
idea.
It's a small little thing, but I discovered that, and I don't know if it's always been this way, but I also discovered that if you wanted to see an organized by date list of all your prior purchases, you just go to the store, view my account, and click purchase history, and there it is, organized by date. I don't know if that's always been there, but I found that in the new one, and I think that's cool too.
Merlin, you don't want to do that because that number is awfully large.
No, I don't like to look at that. You know, I agree with you, Scott. I mean, I feel like I am still finding so much stuff in this every day.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, have you guys gotten into this whole the skipping thing yet?
What's
where it
that?
Can track. I mean, I'm not even sure I get this right. Have you gotten this, Scott, where it'll determine whether you skipped over songs? And so it'll kind of, is that how that works? It basically remembers, banana. Let's leave this part out. This is speculation.
I don't know anything about it, Merlin.
I'll Google this and be ready for the next one.
All right. Let's skip ahead.
But there's all kinds of great stuff. You know what I love in this one is the gapless playing. It seems like such a stupid thing, but you were talking about classical music. I mean, but even, you know, gosh, listening to, you name it, Genesis Records, back when they were still really good. You know, and it's all basically one long record, and not having that little janky skip makes a huge difference.
Wonderful. Merlin,
have you paged through your album art?
Incessantly.
Mine's not anywhere close to complete. I keep saying download it, download it, download it, and I still have lots of empty albums.
I have a thought on that. I mean, why can't I remember this? Coverflow? Is that the name of the app that it's based on? Yeah. I think Coverflow was pulling in the images from Amazon. Is that right? I know, like, for example, I can never remember the names of these apps, but there was the one that would, like, show your entire desktop would be all album covers. Those pull in based on Amazon data, and I think the Amazon stuff is a little more forgiving. I think if your stuff is, A, if it's not on the iTunes store, and B, if it's not named the way the iTunes store likes, I think that may be part of your problem.
I have way too many blank, you know, like, okay, O Samba, which was the wonderful collections put together by David Byrne of Brazilian Samba Music. Now, that was in stores and nothing.
They don't have that Tropicália record either. That little best of that came out.
Oh, brother, where art thou? Not here. I mean, just things that, boy, you sure think they would have Jesus Christ Superstar, not here. I'm just, so I love it. I think it's great, but it's not complete enough.
All the new hits in the Leo Laporte music library.
Yeah, I'm learning a lot about you. My mind is clearer now.
Jesus Christ Superstar.
Banana.
Nobody in the audience knows what you're talking about, Leo.
Banana. Merlin Mann, your tip of the week.
Oh, man, I had a pretty popular post on mind mapping, something a lot of people enjoy. You know, it's this kind of ability to, like, dump a lot of ideas and kind of make little associations.
Yeah, and we brought back Inspiration.
I loved Inspiration until they started chasing the kindergarten market. Right. That was a terrific app. It's still a good app. I mean, but you know what I discovered? My buddies over at Omni Group, one of my favorite companies, I can't say enough good things about, they pointed out that OmniGraffle Pro, I don't know if you've seen this. Do you have OmniGraffle Pro?
I do, yeah.
It's got a built-in outlining ability that lets you basically, it pops out as a little drawer on the side and lets you basically ad hoc generate, same way you would an Omni Outliner, generate these super fast outlines that can be generated just like Inspiration into semantic mind maps. And it's really fast to do. I'll have a post coming up on this. Ken Case told me some really great super secret commands for quickly generating lots of symbols. And so I'm having a heck of a time with that. I mean, because there's some good apps out there, but some of them are pretty costly. And some of the open source ones are a little, you know, feels like you're in swing or something. You know what I mean? It's got that kind of feeling. Omni Group makes such great polished apps. And so I'm having a lot of fun with that. Got a big post coming up on that. So I'm mind mapping.
I'm going to steal for my tip of the week something from that you just told me about, Merlin. So it's really Merlin's tip. It's new from Rogue Amoeba. It's a new audio editing program called Fission. Break it down, as in nuclear fission. I've been looking for a good audio editor. I actually still edit my stuff on Windows. I'm ashamed to say it's the last Windows app I still use regularly. It's Adobe Audition. And Soundtrack Pro, the high-end program from Apple, just doesn't do it for me. I've tried Felt Tip Studios Sound Studio, and not quite it yet either. But I'm looking forward to it. I like Rogue Amoeba's stuff. I think Audio Hijack Pro is a great program, and I'm really looking forward to seeing
Fission's
it.
It's like a really sharp little paring knife.
Literally.
It's there to help you. I mean, if you've done a lot of podcast recording or whatever, if you've, say, you know, let's say, let's look at it this way. Let's say you've used Hijack to grab a stream while you were gone, so you got, you know, 8 hours of music. This is going to really quickly help you run in and split that into separate files, which is
it finds
pain in
silence
the butt
and all that stuff. And you know, if I've done it right, you're not going to hear the word banana once in this podcast, and that's just how good this editor is.
Are you going to edit that one out, that banana?
Oh, wait a minute. Now it's
twice. You're fractal. Now you're fractal.
Now there's two bananas, three bananas, four. Let's stop right here and say good night to everybody. Scott Bourne is part of the iLife Zone, a great podcast and website. Also, it's Podcast Zone. Is that the...
Podcastingtricks.com.
Podcast, because you do the tricks sites. So there's, you know, there's Aperture Tricks and now podcastingtricks.com.
And Blogging Tricks.
Blogging Tricks.
And My Photo Tricks, if you want the whole slew.
Wonderful. If you're looking for a trick, Scott Bourne's your John.
Banana.
I can see that one coming from about 50 yards.
You can actually hear me thinking on that one. Merlin Mann is at 43folders.com, and I don't have any jokes for him. I just invite you to come back and see us again next Tuesday for Mac Break Weekly.